On Tech News Today, everybody's talking about the shell shock exploit, but what are the big tech companies doing about it? Plus, everyone's also talking about Elo, a social network with no ads, no personal data collection, no real names policy, and no apparent way to make money. Plus, the Russian government is threatening to block Google, Facebook, and Twitter if they don't comply with the country's new anti-free speech law. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, September 26th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TNT when you check out. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. And Jason Howell.
Hello.
How sad are you that the Samsung Galaxy Note Edge is not a real product? Not really.
Well, I mean, so it sounds like they're kind of testing the waters with this, which 2 years ago when they showed it off initially at CES as a proof of concept, it's kind of what it was then, too. It's weird that it was part of this full announcement and then suddenly kind of getting peeled back a little bit. I thought the technology is cool because it's different and interesting. Just, you know, I want to get my hands on it. But, you know, especially in light of kind of this news, kind of makes sense. It's different. Don't know if it's different, you know, because it brings with it all this, you know, new functionality that people really want. But it's neat that they're trying something. I just think it's weird that they've officially announced it and then they're kind of going back a little bit.
It is weird. I mean, specifically, the company president, Samsung president, DJ Lee, told ZDNet Korea that the Galaxy Note Edge, that's the one that's sort of curved down on the side, and there's an actual screen that's sort of at an angle on the side, was just a limited edition concept. It'll be sold in Korea in small numbers and won't be sold outside of Korea as far as I can tell. What drives me crazy is they go to all the work to develop the R&D. They actually set up manufacturing to actually make this thing. They build a custom user interface, an entire didn't they say there was going to be an SDK for for the little strip on the side?
Yes.
And then they announce, but we're not really going to sell it, not really, just for a few people. Although it has to be said that these are going to be collector's items. I mean, this would be a hot item. But if they sell it only in Korea, it's going to be in the Korean language.
Well, so here at Twit, we have bowls around the studio filled with ancient cell phone technology. I think that we kind of have to get one of these just to put in those bowls at the very least.
Yeah, something right. For the bowl.
Yeah.
All right. We also have today with us our guest co-anchor, Christina Warren. Welcome to you, Christina.
Hello.
So glad you're here. Now, you had an awesome appearance on Bloomberg TV where you're talking about Uber and Lyft and all its various troubles. Now, that was a very New York-centric conversation, a bunch of New Yorkers sitting around talking about public transportation. Here in California, we have serious need for good rides and that sort of thing. And, of course, in L.A. and San Francisco, the governments there are seeking injunctions, possibly, and civil penalties against Sidecar, Uber, and Lyft. And essentially, the charges are that they misled customers about driver background checks and were unfairly calculating fares. Do you think that these charges are legit, or is this just the traditional transportation industry exerting pressure to crack down on this upstart?
You know, I mean, I think that there's definitely some validity to maybe some of the background check stuff. And then certainly the firms that I knew that Uber and Lyft have used in the past have had some issues, right? And I mean, they're new companies, as they like to say, they're going to be growing pains and startups. I would actually be curious about what sorts of background checks go involved with the various taxi systems. And I would be curious to know how much more strenuous that is, just for comparison purposes, not to imply that they're any less, but just out of curiosity. I think when it comes to the shared fare stuff, that becomes a little bit more, to me, it seems more of legislation punitive based on legislation, trying to kind of get these people out of there, because the cabbies, especially in LA and definitely in San Francisco, are so annoyed with these services. It almost feels like that's behind these crackdowns more than actually being concerned about the public.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Well, anyway, it was a great appearance I enjoyed watching it. Why don't we jump into the news? We reported yesterday on the bash or shell shock bug. After two decades of existence, the flaw suddenly emerged to become the threat of the decade. In the ensuing 24 hours, much has happened and much has been learned. Joining us today is Renee Ritchie, the publisher of iMore.com and host of Twit's MacBreak Weekly and other podcasts. Welcome to you, Renee.
Welcome. Thank you, Mike.
And we also have Zach Winner Flinner. How do you say your name, Zach? I'm so sorry.
It's Winner Fligner.
Fligner. Okay. We'll get it right from now on. You wrote about shell shock for Quartz, and I welcome you to Tech News Today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, Renee, before we get into the details, can you briefly explain exactly what shell shock is?
So I am far from an expert in bash, but my understanding is that there's an exploit where if you have internet services running, there can be variables that are passed through those services that can use the bash system, which is installed in Linux and Unix-based computers, including OS X, to then sort of issue commands to your computer. If you want to be sensationalistic about it, you can say take over your computer. It depends on exactly how the computer is configured, whether they can get in or not, but it's definitely a major vulnerability to a tool that's been installed in Unix machines for decades.
So who's most at risk here? What you know, obviously we know that this is infecting millions of computers are vulnerable, but who are the people who are most at risk right now?
It's interesting because people who are, at least from an OS X point of view, most people won't be affected because they simply won't have things like internet servers running on their machine. They don't start running by default. You have to actually go in and start them or run OS X server or something. And those people are also the most capable of turning off those services or launching Xcode and updating bash manually themselves before, you know, Apple's promised to fix quickly, but even before that happens.
So it's basically affecting web servers. I guess that's what I'm trying to kind of get across. So this is mostly going to be affecting major web servers, not something that right now, anyway, regular users need to worry about as much, at least for their personal machines.
Yeah, especially people, anyone running a server center, anyone running an IT department, anyone at home who just is, you know, an advanced user and is running all their own software services, those kind of people.
Now, Zach, you wrote that the shell shock bug imperils the whole internet. What did you mean by that?
Well, so the internet really mostly runs on Unix-based systems. An internet survey that's conducted every few months by a company called Netcraft found that basically just 13% of the busiest 1 million websites are running Microsoft web servers. And, you know, Microsoft doesn't use bash. So obviously those people are not vulnerable to shell shock. Now, most of the other servers on the internet are running Unix-based systems. Most of those Unix systems do have bash installed. So they are, you know, potentially vulnerable.
Won't this just be patched and all will go back to normal?
So actually for a lot of the big websites, a lot of the responsible websites, they've been really good about, you know, rolling out the patches that have been published. So for sites that are on top of things, it's going to be okay. You know, Amazon rolled out the patch very quickly. I'm sure a lot of the other large companies did as well. Where this is likely to have an impact is for servers who, you know, maybe they don't get updated as frequently. Maybe their IT team is just not as on top of it. So I'm guessing we're likely to see shell shock exploits for months, just as we've sort of seen Heartbleed exploits for months.
So, you know, the code that's been around, you know, obviously it goes back to, I think, you know, 1.13 version of bash. So, I mean, it's a 25-year-old bug. But it's suddenly getting, you know, major attention now. Do you think that this raises questions about the, you know, Eric Raymond's old, you know, Linus's law theory that, you know, many eyes make all bugs shallow, that just because something's open and the code's available doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's actually going to look at it? What do you think this says kind of about the thought that with enough people involved and looking at code, all these bugs will be found?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And I think the big takeaway here is that sometimes the difficult things in software, like quality assurance, those are not the most fun things to do. And if many eyes had actually been looking at this code, and then this bug would have been found relatively quickly. But in fact, the many eyes are mostly focused on developing new features. And so I mean, certainly, like, this is not an argument against open source. Open source systems have done a lot of great things. but it does raise questions about the many eyes quotation and, you know, how true that is, that there actually are many eyes watching.
Now, Rene Ritchie, shell shock was widely reported to affect OS 10. What was Apple's response to this?
Actually, Apple gave us a statement yesterday evening. Said the vast majority of OS 10 users are not at risk. Bash is a Unix command shell language is installed in OS 10. With OS 10, systems are safe by default and not exposed to remote exploits of Bash unless users configure advanced Unix services. Whether you consider advanced Unix services to be something like starting a web server, you know it's a nuance. You can have a discussion about that. But if you just buy a Mac at an Apple store and you bring it home, a regular old Mac, you won't be vulnerable to shell shock. At least as we understand it right now.
I see. And what about the Internet of Things? I'll start with you, Zach. The Internet of Things widely uses Bash. And an interesting attribute of this, and which distinguishes it from Heartbleed, is that you don't really have to break into a computer to use it. You don't really have to hack the password or crack anything. You can essentially execute it in many cases. And it's possible that, you know, as we've said, this has been around for a long time, it's been exploited for a long time. Of course, it's going to get exploited a lot more because it's getting all this news. But the Internet of Things, and also things like the Internet of Things, for example, webcams sometimes run Bash, routers, those kinds of devices. Plus, who knows what kind of, you know, automated door openers, smoke detectors. Internet of Things devices run this, and of course, they are often connected to the Internet. So what's the prospect for getting these Internet of Things devices fixed and protected from this problem?
Well, Mike, I think you've touched on one of the big challenges with this bug. You're right that so many Internet of Things devices are, you know, running embedded Linux systems, and unlike a company like Google or Amazon, who can quickly roll out a change and update to all of their servers, I think that a lot of, you know, the Internet of Things companies may not have the infrastructure to actually serve a software update out to the people who own those devices. The people who own those devices might not be necessarily aware that they're even vulnerable to these attacks. So, of course, it's hard to say precisely, but I'm guessing that a lot of the exploits, or at least proof of concepts of exploits that we're going to see in the coming weeks and months, are going to be with Internet of Things devices that are running embedded Linux systems.
Rene Ritchie is at iMore.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Rene Ritchie, and you can, of course, watch him here on Twit at MacBreak Weekly. Thanks for joining us, Rene Ritchie.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Christina.
All right. And Zach Wenner-Fligner is at QZ.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at ZachWE. Thank you so much for joining us, Zach.
Thanks a lot.
All right. In just a sec, we're going to talk about not a brand new social network, but everybody's talking about it suddenly. But first, I want to talk about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is going to help you get your money together. It does this literally together. It brings all your financial information that's spread out all over the internet on all these different accounts with all these different companies, brings all that data together and puts it in a single graph or chart or explanation about what's happening. It will watch all of those sources for your personal financial information and notify you when something is going to happen. It'll help you save money on the fees you're probably overpaying on, and it's free. So right off the bat, you're going to save money, most likely, with Personal Capital. It saved me money right away when I started using it some time ago, and it saved me more money when I started using the Android Wear app that they support. One of the first companies to support Android Wear, Personal Capital has an Android app that you simply install on your Android phone, and if you have Android Wear, it will sort of push that information out to your wrist. So when anything happens to your money, bzzzt, your wrist gets buzzed, and you look down at your wrist, and there is the vital information that you need to know. It's super cool, and it's really a great example of where wearable computing can really materially help you in your day-to-day life. To set up a free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember, Personal Capital is free, and it's clearly the smart way to grow your money. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of Tech News Today. Well, suddenly everybody's talking about an ad-free social network called Elo. The site's creators say Elo is an independent site. It allows pseudonyms, and it doesn't harvest personal data. In other words, it's the anti-Facebook. And unlike Facebook, Elo has no apparent way to make money. Carissa Bell is a reporter for Mashable and joins us now. Welcome to you, Carissa.
Hi.
So Elo's been around for a while. Why is everybody suddenly talking about it?
Well, it's not completely clear why it hasn't really blown up in the last week or so, but one of the things a lot of people have been speculating about is that it came out after there was this big outcry over Facebook's real name policy that upset a lot of people recently because they were forcing Facebook users to use their given legal names, and that created a lot of problems.
So how exactly does Elo differ from these services, other than just the privacy implications and the fact that they don't harvest your user data? What's different about actually using the service yourself? And is there anything about the service that makes it actually worth using, you know, other than using Twitter or Facebook or Google Plus or anything else?
Right. Well, actually, you know, its features are, you know, not that different than a lot of other social networks. You can post status updates, photos, GIFs, you know, add friends, reply to comments, that kind of thing. So that in itself isn't hugely different. They do have a very long list of features that they want to add in the future, but it's not really clear when those are going to actually roll out.
You know, one of the things that makes me nervous about a site like this is they haven't said how they're going to make money. Obviously, they have to make some money. If they get a lot of users, they're going to have to pay for the bandwidth and the servers and all that kind of stuff. And it seems to me that the only way to make money if you don't have ads and you don't collect personal information is to charge admission, kind of like app.net. And this sounds great when you are, you know, a fairly well-to-do first worlder. But if you get out there into the wider world, I mean, you know, you look at sites like Twitter and Google Plus and Facebook, these are, you know, admission is free. They're very democratic. Somebody who makes, you know, $30,000 a year or $10,000 a year or $5,000 a year can afford to use these social networks, whereas if they charge admission, if you can't use it unless you pay $10 or $50 or whatever it is, then it becomes a sort of a private country club for people who have a lot of disposable income. If they don't charge admission, how are they going to make money? I mean, this is really kind of a confounding question.
So the creators have actually said that they're not going to charge admission necessarily, but they're thinking about going the freemium model so that they'll add new features down the line and then make those available for payment so that you'll have the option of buying certain features. And that's how they're going to make the money.
So we've seen this kind of attempt at creating a new type of social network before. You know, Mike mentioned app.net, which died on the vine. And I should admit, I paid, I think, for 2 years worth of app.net. I paid $125 or $150 to support them. You know, there was Identica, there was Diaspora. There have been these various, you know, attempts to build things up before, and none of them have succeeded. Obviously, the attention around Elo this week has been really high for whatever reason. Do you think that they have any plans to make this service so that it's sticky, so that it doesn't just become something that we talked about for a week in September, but actually becomes a sustainable service that people actually want to go to?
I mean, it's hard to say right now. I think that, you know, if you talk to them, that they would probably, you know, say that, yeah, they have a, you know, they have a plan. They want to, you know, get that engagement going. And, you know, they say that they're getting 30,000 requests for signups an hour. So, I mean, and those numbers haven't been verified yet, but if that is true, they're getting that many people, I mean, then, you know, that certainly would suggest that they might, you know, might be in it for a longer run.
Carissa, Elo's actually has a manifesto. And their manifesto says that, or at least it implies, that social networks like Facebook and Twitter exist to, quote, deceive, coerce, and manipulate and turn users into a product. Do you agree with that, or do you think they are full of it?
I'm not sure that I necessarily agree. I mean, you know, social networks make money by, you know, collecting user information and making that available to advertisers, and that's kind of their business model. And, you know, some people take issue with that. I would not say that they exist to coerce and manipulate you, but, you know, some people think that. And I think that's why Elo is so appealing right now, because, you know, people have a lot of, you know, concerns about what, you know, Facebook and Twitter are doing with your information and what they're giving to advertisers. And, you know, so I think this is really indicative of that, you know, people have that concern.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That concern does exist out there. And I actually like the design. It kind of looks like a typewritten piece of paper or something. It's very minimalist and stark. It's kind of cool, kind of refreshing. It's in every way the opposite of Facebook. Carissa Bell is at Mashable.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Carissa B-E. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, the Russian state media watchdog called Roskomnadzor sent notices to Silicon Valley giants Google, Facebook, and Twitter ordering them to obey Russian law or face the possibility of being blocked in Russia, according to a report in the Moscow Times. They're being required to officially register within the next 3 months as, quote, organizers of information distribution, unquote, under a law that's expected to suppress free speech in Russia. One immediate requirement is that they store all information inside, you know, on Russian users inside Russia on those servers. So they have to move all the data on Russian users into the country, presumably making them available to the Russian government, Russian police, or whatever. Christina Warren, is this a terrible thing, and do you think they will have any choice but to comply?
You know, it has the potential to be pretty damning for free speech. In terms of compliance, I mean, that becomes a really tricky question, right? Because it could go a number of ways. I think that one of the interesting things here is that it's interesting that the Russian government is trying to impose these things on U.S. companies. Yet when U.S. companies try to impose things like copyright provisions against Russian companies, you know, we're told, you know, to you know, go away and it's ignored. So I think that actually becomes kind of an interesting question. And lawyers would know better than I would. You know, I'm not a lawyer, so about what they're actually entitled to have to do. But it is interesting that they're taking this approach, because obviously China has had success with you know, banning Google and having, you know, some other companies blocked from, you know, their users. I think what's potentially will be a saving grace in this is that if Russian users backlash against what the government's trying to do and are really angry about it and are really trying to come up with ways around these things, it's possible that they might be able to back down a little bit, at least against some of the more really kind of, you know, spurious sanctions of saying things like, you know, you've got to follow us to the exact law. I think maybe having servers there, that might be something that could be worked out, but, or at least copies of data there, it could be something that could be worked out, but it really depends.
One of the strange things about this is that the law is called the blogger's law. Obviously, Google's not a blogger. Twitter's not a blogger. Of course, they have bloggers on the service, but this law was enacted and it was supposed to be enforced by the end of next year. And then the Russian legislature moved it up a year. So they're really, I guess, rushing into it.
Ah!
Yeah, I know. Terrible. Well, just a sec. We've got another iPhone 6 update. But first, I want to tell you about Harry's. Harry's, if you're a man and you shave your face, and, you know, some of us do, you're going to want to sign up for Harry's right away. And here's why. First of all, most of the razors you find out there are low quality and overpriced, and Harry's is the opposite. They're super high quality razors made by their own factory in Germany, and they're very low priced. One of the founders of Harry's was one of the founders of Warby Parker, and it's a very similar model where they have really brought down the price and made it super simple and convenient to get these razors, the shaving cream and shaving gel and all these other really, really great products. They have a minimal design. You're not going to have some ugly, you know, thing that looks like it's from Battlestar Galactica in your bathroom. These are really nice razors. They look cool. They're highly functional and they're low cost. My favorite part, because I'm lazy, is they come right to my door. I don't have to go and remember to go get them at the store or whatever. I never run out. They just come right to me, and it's just a fantastic, fantastic service, and I recommend it to everybody listening to this show. Go to harrys.com. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S. Use the promo code TNT. That'll get you $5 off your first purchase. And remember, that's harrys.com, promo code TNT. And we thank Harry's for their support of Tech News Today. Well, the iPhone 6 went on sale today in 22 more countries, including Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Ireland, Isle of Man, Italy, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Portugal, Qatar, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Taiwan, Turkey, and United Arab Emirates. You didn't think I was going to read the whole list, but there it is, all 22 of them. Well, we've been covering the legality, or more accurately, the illegality of the commercial flying of drones in the land of the free. But now the FAA has responded to applications from Hollywood studios and pressure from the Motion Picture Association of America. They've now granted permission for six companies to use camera drones, but only on TV and movie sets and only during the day. It is progress, though. This is the first time the FAA has ever granted permission for drones to fly over human beings. Christina Warren, this is a very tenuous first step. I don't understand why they don't just broadly legalize, and then if somebody, you know, shreds somebody with a drone, then prosecute them. Or I don't know. There's got to be a better way than this sort of painstaking, like gradual. They're going to allow a lot more drone flying. Why don't they get to it?
No, without a doubt. I think that what's interesting here is that, you know, Hollywood proves once again that they're able to get a lot more done than a lot of tech companies. which is kind of funny. You know, people always like to talk about how Hollywood is so behind the times, but when it comes to legislative muscle, they really do have the best lobbyists around. And the MPAA is obviously, you know, a humongous lobbying group. But I think it's also kind of a great example of, yeah, I mean, drones can cut down significantly on costs for aerial camera shots, and it can get all kinds of, you know, footage that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, or you would have to hire a private pilot and you know, spend a lot more money to get something similar. But yeah, I mean, they're going to have to come up with a better method than this, because people are buying these things, they're using them, they're doing their own aerial photography, they're doing their own kind of, you know, various experiments with drones. This is not going to go away. And the FAA is going to need to, you know, really step up if they want to be ahead of this, which I think is what we all want, right? Because it's going to become a reality. Now let's put regulations in place to make it safe, but not to say this isn't going to happen, because it's going to happen. It's already happening.
Yeah, it's already happening. And what American companies are doing, they're going to Canada or Australia or some other place where it's legal to fly these things. They're like Cuban cigars or something. I mean, it's just like, it's bizarre to have this sort of prohibition on flying drones when the drone industry in the United States is so robust. There's so much manufacturing, development, and innovation around drones in the United States, and yet you can't really fly them. It's just completely bizarre. Well, during a recorded interview on the iPhone 6 release in Amsterdam, a blogger got his iPhone stolen by somebody riding by in a scooter. Jason, let's take a look at this hilarious video. So you see his iPhone 6. He's standing there, blah, 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 talking, and boom.
No way.
Gone. Gone with the wind. The thief will be disappointed to learn that the phone was a dummy. It was actually a fake iPhone 6. And all that for nothing. It was an impressive, grab. I mean, it's like it's raining kind of, and he just got it and he didn't drop it. He was going like 20 miles an hour.
He was practiced. I have a feeling this wasn't his first drive and grab.
And steal.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What is it about these iPhone launches in other countries where, you know, the guy drops it and almost breaks it, but it's okay. You know, somebody gets the fake one stolen. Like, America's got to catch up, because
I know
our launch stories are just boring, man.
Yeah, they really are. The most exciting thing about our launch is that, you know, most of the people in line are buying them to import them to China.
Exactly. Like ours are depressing and sad. These are like, oh, wow. Somebody just linked it, you know, from a passing scooter. And I'm with you. Like, props to the guy on the scooter who had that much coordination to steal that. I mean, I don't know if props is the right term, but I mean, that was impressive.
It's exactly the right term, actually. Our TNT fan of the day is, well, Jason, why don't we just roll the video and let him introduce himself?
Hey guys, I'm Gene Roney from Doolittle County, Georgia. I'm what you call a high-tech redneck. I wanted to share with you where I listen to Tech News Today and all my favorite TWIT programs. Inside my John Deere tractor with its Trimble GPS guidance system, I got a Bluetooth noise canceling headset, a Note 3 with unlimited data plan. You gotta love that technology. Well, I got to get back to doing my thing. You guys keep up the good work. Tell Leo I said hey, and I've been with him since the screensaver days. Y'all ever get down to Georgia, y'all come by and see us now. You hear?
Definitely will. We get down to Georgia, and eventually we will. That was awesome. That was
an awesome
video.
I'm from Georgia, so that's awesome to see. Go Noonan County. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Could you tell what he was growing? I was sort of looking at the plant life in the background. I couldn't identify it.
Soybeans, maybe? I don't know. Soybeans are big in Georgia. I don't know.
It could have been. Soybeans. Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just take a picture or video of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it. That is the Tech News Today. Christina Warren, thank you so much for coming on as our guest co-anchor. What have you been working on right now?
Some of the kind of trying to geek-splain the shell shock stuff to everybody, and that's been taking up some time, as well as all the never-ending Bendgate drama, because now there are conspiracy theories about whether or not the phones are really bent or not, whether or not this has all been some mass conspiracy to make Apple look bad. I'm not joking, you guys. There are Reddit threads about it. It's kind of awesome.
Wow. Looking forward to that and your geek-splanations of all the rest. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS. So many options. Choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. You can join our Google+ community. Just search Google+ for Tech News Today and you'll find us. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Comment on Twitter or Google+ using the hashtag Tech News Today, or send email to tnt@twit.tv, or leave voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.